Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. This is a no-holds-barred show. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, tonight, my guest is a psychologist. His name is Brent Potter. He's a psychotherapist and wellness specialist with 20 years of direct clinical service. He is the director for the Society of Langian Studies. He's the author of numerous articles whose topics include innovative and effective mental health care models, analytical psychology, humanistic psychology, existential phenomenology, psychoanalysis, the psychotic register of the mind, character and personality disorders, chemical dependency, and child-adolescent mental health concerns. His first book, Elements of Self-Destruction, is out via Carmack Books, and he has three upcoming books. He'll be talking about those tonight, and he welcomes all correspondents and can be contacted via Facebook or by email at Brent Potter, M-A, at yahoo.com. So, with that said, let me introduce Brent. Brent, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, man. It's great to be here. How are you?
It's great to have you. Thank you. Yes, it's a wonderful life for those of us that can keep that attitude and keep a positive framework into our lives. And you know, I have suffered myself from years of mental illness and depression, and I had mania. And now I lead a balanced life, and I'd like to talk a little bit about those that are having challenges with that and ways that they can both through psychotherapy and possibly through medicine. I'd be especially interested if they could do it just through psychotherapy, overcome things like bipolar disorder, mood disorders, that kind of thing. So how about if we start on that chapter?
Works for me.
Great. What do you have to say?
Well, the way that I formulate, you know, I tend to not refer to psychiatric labels that much. I tend to see just different variations of distress that people experience that tend to fall along typical lines. Someone may feel depressed. Someone may feel anxious. Some may experience unusual states of consciousness that are distressing and things like that. And so I try to, just for my approach, I use more of a descriptive rather than medical sort of way of looking at various forms of human distress. And I see them as varying in degree but not kind from all human experience. I think life has kind of designed into it trauma. We all, no matter what, no matter how well-resourced, how independent, how educated, or lack thereof, or this or that, no matter what the circumstances are, everyone experiences illness, loss, grief, breakups. There are all kinds of things that happen in life that are distressing. And so I think that what is often labeled as mental illness is really just, you know, it varies in degree but not kind from the range of human experience that we all have. And I think that most of us, if we're really honest with ourselves, will admit that there were times where we were distressed or perhaps a little bit more sensitive or, you know, having all kinds of a range of things that I'd often, if someone were to catch sight of us in that particular moment, label as a mental illness, but really is a normal response to environmental circumstances or life circumstances. And I also think that there's a lot of attention right now being paid to a host of studies that have come out. Probably the best one is the Adverse Childhood Event, or ACE, study. And basically we understand now that a lot of things that are labeled as mental health condition and or substance abuse or dependence is often the result of developmental stress and or trauma. So there's a lot more. It's good news. I'm glad that everyone, or a lot of us right now who follow the research, are talking a lot more about these varieties of distress as really things that are the logical outcome of developmental stress so early on and or trauma that happens often early on, that later those are things that are, you know, they have reverberations later in life. Or in the case of chemical dependency, oftentimes people are trying to medicate pain. They're mm-hmm. trying to medicate trauma. They're trying to take care of themselves. But, you know, sometimes the ways of taking up ways of self-care in and of themselves can lead to more problems, even though that's not what the person intends. So it's a complicated situation, but in a nutshell, that's how I tend to view varieties of mental or emotional distress.
Well, I find that that's a very humanistic approach to different conditions. I like the fact that you don't use labels. I think they're very limiting. Everything that you say makes common sense to me. I certainly, as a survivor of childhood trauma and having been labeled with mental health diagnoses, having experienced chemical dependency and other addiction issues, can relate to that self-medication stuff. And for me, I want to say that my manias both surfaced when I came out of addiction, and I had this profound spiritual experience that took me flying so high that I kind of lost touch with reality. And so I'd be interested in exploring that too. But I really like what you have to say. It sounds very kind and compassionate, and I think that we have an awful lot to learn about mental illness, quote-unquote mental illness, and I love the way you refer to it as distress. And the other thing that I'd like to explore is what we can do to stay in a place where we do not allow distress to disturb our serenity or take us from a place of joy. What do you think about that? Is that possible?
Absolutely. I think it's possible. There are a few different ways that I kind of conceptualize of that. And, you know, one of them that really shocks a lot of my colleagues is that I don't believe that psychotherapy is necessarily the magic bullet cure for everything.
I agree.
Think that, like, right. Yeah, I think psychotherapy is wonderful. It's been very, very helpful with me personally. A lot of my colleagues that I know have been in psychotherapy. It's very wonderful, supportive, helpful. I would dare even say life-saving at times. But you know, that one, right, yeah, but that one thing, nor any one thing, I think, is the one solution to just be copied and pasted across all people. So I like to try and think of varieties of distress also within the individual context. You know, sometimes it's psychotherapy. Sometimes it's not psychotherapy. Sometimes it's a little bit of psychotherapy in combination with some kind of social support, maybe a group, maybe some psychoeducational stuff. Sometimes for some of people that I know, it's just getting out into nature. Or maybe it's getting out into nature and looking at one's nutrition and a little bit of psychotherapy. So there's all kinds of varieties of things that people can put together that become kind of an individualized plan, as it were, for the individual. And I think that if that's maintained, then, you know, distressing states, like I said, will come up from time to time for all of us. But fundamentally, it doesn't move one off base if they've kind of figured out what works well for their own wellness program.
Well, you know, I talk about some of those things in my latest book, Occam's Razor Revisited. By the way, the subtitle to that is A Simple Solution to Freedom from All Addictions, and it weaves my life around a variety of themes, including recovery from mental illness and addiction. But I maintain that it is action that can be life-saving, and that it's not necessary to do the 30 years of psychotherapy that I did. It's not necessary, although very helpful, to do 12-step programs. There are other solutions if people want to find a simpler way. It's out there, and I don't propose to have all the answers, but I think I have some pretty good ones. And when you talked about taking a walk out in nature, I mean, other things that I propose are calling a friend, playing with a pet, playing with your child, cooking, doing whatever is your passion, be it painting, listening to uplifting music. I mean, there's so many things you can do. Volunteer work is a wonderful way to get out of yourself. So these are different things that I propose. And, you know, we live in a dualistic world. And when you talked about psychotherapy being good, I do believe that it can be. I think it can also be bad, because a lot of times it takes people deep into trauma that is so devastating that I almost do not think it should be revisited, not unless the trauma comes up and then is dealt with. But I think to take somebody into trauma is a form of malpractice. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think that, unfortunately, along with the sort of hegemony, really, of the medical model in human emotional kind of affairs or ways of being in the world, one of the things that has gone along with that is kind of a hijacking, if you will, of psychology and psychotherapy, where now psychotherapy is considered, you know, basically it's code and procedure. If you meet the DSM criteria in one of their opinions for that, then it's just a matter of applying the appropriate intervention or interventions for symptom reduction. And I think that that really obfuscates, you know, for example, is that the right kind of approach to something that is emotional distress? Is it really just code and procedure? Is it a good fit between the client and the professional? I think that that's important, that the professional care about the client as a human person and not just someone who has a chemically imbalanced or otherwise malfunctioning brain organ from their perspective. Do you kind of see the difference?
I encourage
people who are interested in psychotherapy to make sure that, you know, this is an intimate relationship when you're working with someone, telling them things and trusting them to really find someone who they feel is a good fit to not just take the fruit, because that person, whomever they're speaking to, may or may not see people from kind of a medicalized perspective of applying code and procedure to a certain, what they consider to be a psychiatric disease. I mean, that's very, very different than finding, let's say, a therapist, if one is interested in therapy, who wants to see them as a human person, who really cares about them, who believes, for example, in seeing the parts of them that are growth-oriented. There's nothing in the medical model. Once you have a disease, there's nothing like a growth-oriented about that. The best you can hope for is to put it in remission, you know, because there's no complete cure in most cases from their perspective of disease. And, you know, I'm not sure if it were me that I would want to work with someone who just wants to see me leave working with them as a symptom-reduced person or something to that effect. I mean, I would hope that I would be working with someone, if it were me, who wants to see me well, centered, and successful, as I define those things for myself. So You know, yeah, and I think that in the cases, perhaps as you were alluding to, where psychotherapy is seen as that code and procedure, objective, medical-like procedure, that, yeah, I think that that could be potentially harmful. And I think that, you know, perhaps people, there are probably those out there, too, who may want to take people back into trauma, and that's not necessarily the case. Some people need to face these things, and some don't. It all depends
yeah.
upon the individual and the approach that they're using. I kind of like the when you were talking about trying all of those different things, you know, the attitude of willingness to get better, taking action, I think is you really hit something, the nail on the head there, because, you know, a wellness approach or a recovery approach is going to try all of those different things, and maybe they'll say, okay, well, listening to music helps me about a 7 on a 1 to 10, but at least now that I've tried it, I know it's about a 7. So it's kind of helpful. It's pretty helpful. Not all the way helpful.
Yeah.
So but maybe the walk in the woods is like a 9. So maybe sometimes I can listen to music. Do you see what I mean? It's like formulating, experimenting, trying until they come up with that thing. But that all requires action. As you point out, you can't just not do anything and then expect things to change. It does take some brave work and some real consideration of what are the range of things I'm willing to try and then, you know, what works in the end.
Well, I think of the name of my show, Different Strokes for Different Folks. What works well for one person may not work well for another. And so I think
Correct.
It is a matter of trial and error and finding the right formula for the individual, because we're all unique in our life experiences and life expressions. And for those who don't know the DSM, what that manual is, would you explain what that is?
Sure. It's the so-called Bible of Psychiatry. It stands for Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's presently on the 5th edition. It's the manual that all healthcare providers who are looking at emotional, psychological forms of distress use to ascribe labels. Those labels are coded. Those codes are what are used to often bill insurance. And sometimes, not always, will indicate the modality to be recommended, which is usually these days manualized or cognitive behavioral therapies. So these are very kind of practical, some of us consider them superficial, kind of approaches to seeing things very objectively, thoughts and feelings, and identifying those and then replacing those.
Thank you, Brent. Let's talk a little bit about your books. I'm especially interested, I don't know the other titles that are coming up, but I am interested in the book Elements of Self-Destruction. Where would you like to begin?
Oh, well, thanks, The Elements of Self-Destruction is my first book. It came out about a year ago. And really what I was looking at there are, human beings who we strive to do so many great things, how is it that human beings can come up with these multiple varieties, individually as well as collectively, of just destroying ourselves? That was a really fascinating question, both individually, how the individual mind comes to a point where engaging in self-destructive behavior becomes kind of a strategic option at self-survival, it turns out, somewhat paradoxically. And then the more I looked at that, the more I think anyone who turns on the news today would just really be surprised at how collectively organization, a nation, a combination of groups of people organize themselves in such a way as to be self-destructive or individually and collectively self-destruction projected outward, which is other destruction. So just the level of violence and destructiveness in the world. Then I've got a second one coming up after that called Elements of Reparation, Truth, Faith, and Transformation in the Works of Heidegger Beyond. And that one looks at basically truth, faith, transformation, utilizing some wisdom from Greek antiquity. I just keep getting drawn there. That looks at these processes and the role that faith plays in them, and by that I don't necessarily mean at all religious faith. The word faith in Greek is and refers to faith in self, faith in the process, faith in life, or what happens when faith is absent in the process, and also metanoia, which is a word that I loosely translate as a transformation. Carl Jung used that word, so did Artie Lang from that tradition, to mean a transformative experience, such that in a similar vein that what you were just asking about, you know, it means that sometimes these distressing processes that move through us are seeking wholeness. And if one can be supported in this metanoia process that's moving through one, then that process invariably leads to wholeness. So it's a transformative process. It's a spiritual process in contrast to something like a biological disease, that the central nervous system is just a malfunctioning machine somehow, but it has an actual teleos, it has a logos, it has a logic and direction to it. So that's one of the other books that's coming out. And then I've got another one coming out in a couple weeks. It's co-authored with Jacqueline Simon Gunn that looks specifically at borderline personality disorder.
Ooh.
And, yeah, I know. That's the one everyone's excited about. Borderline personality disorder seems to ring the bell. Yeah.
I used to be a psychiatric social worker, and those were the most difficult clients for me to work
with.
There
you go. Yeah, that one's everyone's interested in that one. Yeah, and that was really, really excited about that.
Good.
I'm really excited about it because we were able to, Jackie and I were able to really look at where that diagnosis came from, and it was tough to write, man, because on the one hand, we had to honor that it is a form of distress, even though it shouldn't be called that psychiatric label, but there are forms of distress. Emotional chaos is one of them. But on the other hand, acknowledge that a form of distress, emotional chaos, does exist. But on the other hand, to look at where did this come from? How does this arrive to us in 2014 as this? Does it have? And sure enough, it's a social construction reaching back. Man, I started doing the research on it, and I went back 4,000-plus years, and you can find medical stuff, ancient Egypt and then through Greece. It has a fascinating history to it that arrives to us today, not by accident, and remains substantially unchanged throughout all of that time. So that one was really exciting to do.
What would be the difference between a borderline personality disorder and somebody that has multiple personalities? Is there, couldn't one lead to the other?
Yeah. Oh, wow, man, that's a good question. So here's, they don't call it multiple. It's called, in the DSM, it's not called multiple. It's called dissociative identity disorder. And so that is a little bit different. However, a lot of people do see that in terms of a variation of borderline personality disorder, and they do so in a few different ways. One way is that a lot of borderline personality disorder, a lot of people consider that to be basically someone who's been subjected to a tremendous amount of trauma. And so then if you basically, if someone is subjected to enough trauma, then you're looking at kind of a range of trauma-specific distress. And in the DSM, that gets labeled as DID, dissociative identity disorder, or borderline personality disorder, or post-traumatic stress disorder. So some people do choose to see DID as a variation of BPD or a more extreme version.
Can we talk about trauma for a minute?
Absolutely.
I mean, you talked about childhood trauma, and of course, trauma can revisit us in different forms. And I look at it at a number of levels, including at a karmic level. I don't know if you believe in reincarnation or not. Certainly to have been a victim as a child predisposes one to becoming a victim as an adult. And I was in that place. I'm a survivor of sexual abuse. I've been raped as a child and as an adult. And, I took it on as it was my fault. And I think that's a very common thing for people to do. In fact, I haven't met anybody yet who is a rape victim who has not thought it was their fault at some level. But, you know, the problem with remaining a victim is that bad things, quote-unquote bad things, continue to happen to that person, and they wonder how they can escape. And, you know, I've learned to become a champion, and it's taken a lot of hard work, but what recommendations would you make to people who are locked in victim consciousness to free themselves?
Ooh, wow, you say a lot there. that's quite a lot of... well, first of all...
I covered a lot of ground, and feel free to address
any of what I said. I'm glad that you seem to think and put things together really quickly. I do, too. So I appreciate the pace of it. But, I mean, first of all, I want to say I'm sorry to hear, you know, that you were subject to a lot of that, and it's a blessing, and you must have done a lot of brave work to be able to be in a place of wellness and recovery today. So, I mean, that's no small feat. That's really Herculean, and that's to be applauded, you know. So, I mean, I guess that kind of leads to the next thing, which is that my suspicion, like you, is that there is such thing as spontaneous recovery, that people just spontaneously heal miraculously, and God bless them. From my understanding of things, the vast majority of people, and you'd be probably in some ways better to speak to this, that it actually takes a lot of hard work, usually involving connecting with someone else, getting out of the victimhood space starts with a decision that I don't like this, and I want to do something about it. And people deserve to have time to feel absolutely bad, depressed, and to or whatever the affective reality is associated with the trauma. It is natural to have all of the feelings and things that go along with that. But usually there comes a point in time where someone says, I don't want to feel this way anymore. And I need to take up my life, or I want to take up my life in a different way. I want to feel more free. I want to not be as burdened with this. So I don't think anyone ever really fully recovers from trauma. It's not like a wound that is completely healed and there's nothing there. I think that it's a matter of how people take it up in the world. It's like, I used to take it up this way, and now I'm taking it up this way, and I'm moving forward in X, Y, and Z ways.
Well, you mentioned spontaneous remissions, and I think that's very interesting, because I've heard of that, and I may have even witnessed some people who've experienced that. I think that's where faith comes in, and ultimately it was faith that freed me. And when you talk about not wanting something to happen anymore, I think that comes to a place of having faith in yourself, that you have the right to choose your own reality. And ultimately, I believe we all choose our own reality and create our own reality, but we need to take that power back before that can happen. What do you think?
Right. Well, if you'd mentioned something about reincarnation or something to that effect, and I'm not going to speak to that. That's like a topic for another show, but briefly stated, you know, the process even of trauma and of things like that, I think that, well, Plato kind of mentions this, that the events of our lives are often things that are always necessary and in the service of something that is to come. That it's somehow, depending upon how we take up the traumas of life, that in and of itself reveals our character, which points the way towards where we are going next. Now, that's not to, I don't want anything that I just said to be interpreted as somehow blaming the victim, or that they chose these things to happen to themselves or someone else.
Right.
That's not what I'm suggesting. What I am suggesting is that these things are not devoid of meaning. They are not accidental, coincidental happenstance of the universe that leaves us victims. They do have meaning and can hold the potential for growth, and can be harnessed in the service of the unfolding of our character and becoming who we are meant to be, if that makes
sense. It does. And I want to just not recant, but I want to restate my position about creating reality and choosing reality. A child does not choose to be molested or physically or emotionally abused. That is blatantly wrong. However, it does create a mindset where the child believes they deserve that, and hence years later, or a repetitive theme can be that those kinds of experiences tend to repeat themselves. And I think it's a matter of waking up to what you were saying, and that is, I don't have to take this anymore. And from that point,
right.
I think
and
you can
you're,
create...
You're right. Yeah. Yeah, and you're alluding to something really important, which is that facet of trauma is that, so there's trauma, and then let's say, for example, it doesn't always have to be this way, a profound sense of shame, guilt, maybe I'm the one, feelings or logic in the mind kind of around those areas. Now that shame and guilt, then other people pick up on, which then sets up the conditions that recapitulate the original trauma. And so now the person unknowingly has put themselves, or somehow other people are attracted to, a lot of victims of trauma report this, that it's almost as if they know they're attracted to me, and I find myself in the same circumstance over and over and over again. I think that's kind of, and Freud called that repetition compulsion. It's as if the events of our lives continue repeating themselves, and it's like, how am I in this situation again? You know, and then to break that kind of cycle, I think, is what you're alluding to, unless I'm mistaken.
Absolutely, and you know, it's interesting when you talked about that repetition trauma. I had this insight one day after having suffered 14 years of debilitating and often suicidal depression. Years later, I realized that I was a depression junkie. And that was a light bulb, and that's not to say that I deserved it or wanted it, but it was just a condition that I was so accustomed to that I returned to it as if it was my comfort zone, while it was indeed my discomfort zone. So I'm not sure if that makes any sense to you, but I, at some level, recreated that reality, and it had also to do with the behaviors I was engaged in, which were attached to guilt and shame, sexual addiction, chemical dependency. And I want to tell you this. I used to drink a case or more of beer a day and smoke and do drugs. Today I can drink, and I don't have more than one or two. And I usually refuse alcohol if it's offered. Now, if I get up in an AA meeting and announce that, I'm going to be told it's impossible. I've been doing this for 10 years after 16 years of abstinence. So, you know, Bernie Siegel agrees with me that once an addict, not always an addict. And I put out there that it's very important to watch what you attach the I am word to, that it should be an affirmative statement. So I do not say I'm an alcoholic. I do not say I'm a sex addict. I say something like, I'm a free spirit who's had an addiction background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, and I don't. I think that to be fair to the 12-step folks, I think that they tend to say, or at least my understanding of the literature is that that program is not for everyone. That it's kind of the last house on the block, so to speak. So even by their own account, they are one approach that seems to work very well for some people. Once again, it goes back to the individual and what his or her needs are.
Yes.
You know, for some people, if that's life-saving, then I say, God bless you, please go. If that's what saves, you know, but for others, maybe even the majority of people, if that approach is not appropriate, then, yeah, to find something else that is, or some combination of things that are, or maybe... you know, you seem to intimate the 12th step is somewhat helpful in some areas and not others. So maybe it's a degree of engagement.
I find it extremely helpful, but I also find that there's a lot of limited thinking that goes on in that,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not going to get into that in this program, but it's just something I've come to discover for myself. But I do believe it was God's gift to the 20th century, and that there was nothing more profound than that at that point in time. I think nearly a century later, that people need to look at other possibilities, and there are a lot of other ways that may be a little bit gentler, because the 12 steps, the fourth step, which is taking a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, can be very traumatic. You know, I'm not here to criticize the program. I believe in saying positive things, and if somebody wants to discuss my problems with the 12-step program, I'm certainly willing to do that via Facebook or email or whatever. Please put forward the premise of your third book, and then I'd like to talk about the book that's out there, because I have a guest in the studio who is very interested in probing you a little bit about that book.
Sure. Which one? The Elements, the borderline one, or what would you like to know about?
Yeah, you want to go into that right now?
Well, whatever you want, or we could dive straight into Elements of Self-Destruction, whatever is best.
Well, why don't you tell us what the third book is going to be, and then we'll talk about the book that's available now.
Oh, okay. So let's see. So the third one that's coming out is going to be a co-edited book with my friend Michael Mantis called The Promethean Effect, Stealing the Fire of Cultural Collapse. What we're going to do in that one is edit a series of essays talking about, basically we're going to talk about what's going on. We're pulling back the lens out of, clinical kind of psychotherapy, or even the psychology arena to take it out into the world and to see, what is going on in the world today with some of these shifts happening, look at some of the critical approaches to what's going on, and most importantly, some of the things that are rising up to take the place of some of the old structures that were there. So it's going to be kind of more of a sociological, perspective on the psychology of our times, if you will.
That's cool. You're very forward thinking, in my opinion, and belief system. Well,
it's
let me bring Jill
time
on
to
the
be
line
in the field because I want to. It's an exciting time to be in the field because so much is changing. We've seen a lot of, in my field, we've seen natural science, psychology, psychiatry have some serious failures. And so those things don't just go as failures. Always something comes in to fill. Like if this didn't work, then let's look at what works. So it's a really exciting transition time. So it's a exciting time to write. These are great, fun things to write about.
Wonderful. Well, I'm glad that you're doing it. And God bless all those people that take a forward-thinking approach. That's how we grow, in my opinion. I have a caller by the name of Jill on the line. And Jill, you're live. Say hello to Dr. Brent Potter.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Oh,
you're welcome.
Hi. I have a three-part question.
Okay,
I have suffered a lot of abuse and trauma because of my family. They have personality disorders or borderline personalities, which I kind of would like you to kind of explain what that is. And because of a lot of trauma to the point, one thing was I was diagnosed with cancer and beat up afterwards. Okay, so because of the trauma and the people in my family who I think have personality disorders or borderline personality, I myself have self-destructed.
Mm-hmm.
So what causes someone to self-destruct, and what is a borderline personality or a personality disorder?
All right. Well, first of all, I'm really sorry. I'm sorry to hear that you had to be subject to what sounds like some horrible trauma. And it's, it should, for anyone that survives that, it's a very brave process that usually involves a lot of hard work. So I think, that's important to mention. Concerning a few of your other questions, it seems like you're raising a really interesting question. It's a little bit latent, but I see it in there and it comes up a lot, which is that, so in a traumatogenic situation or a situation that produces trauma, you have someone whom the trauma is perpetrated against and then someone who's doing that to them. Well, something that is kind of an interesting outcome of some of the research that we know is that, things like borderline personality disorder or that label is a result of a lot of trauma. So people tend to, or at least my colleagues and I, like to not use the psychiatric labels. We could refer to borderline personality disorder as untreated trauma. Not that they need to go to, like, treatment or something, but trauma that's been unaddressed. An individual, they've been very hurt, very traumatized, or been exposed to a lot of stress developmentally. So, in that case, it's interesting to look and see that the people who are also perpetrating some trauma or distress upon someone else themselves are probably been the victims of trauma as well, and that's how these things get transmitted. It's how they roll down through generations. And now we see a lot of people who come in for help who have so much trauma that it's more than one person could possibly bear because it's been rolling down through the generations. So even people who are perpetrating trauma oftentimes are trauma victims themselves. So my hope is that that would provide a more compassionate view without the psychiatric labels and looking at both people who are victimized or traumatized and those who are on the perpetrating end of the trauma. It's just like a self-perpetuating system of trauma.
So what caused me to, there's a lot of other things that we don't have time for, but what caused, and I self-destructed. Why?
Right. Okay. So, but do you understand kind of the first part I'm saying that it kind of rolls down through? So if I'm traumatized, I'm just like in a super brief nutshell. So let's say someone traumatizes me. I take up certain strategies that are survival techniques of knowing and being in the world. Unfortunately, those survival techniques, while self-protecting, are also self-destructive. And so then I become self-destructive, and then let's say I'm in a situation where I don't have, let's say, for example, the parenting skills that are the most conducive towards wellness in my child. All I have is my own traumatized system, things that I've learned, and strategies that I've employed that are self-destructive but also necessary. And now I'm a parent, and now I'm in charge. So then the kid ends up becoming stressed or traumatized because I'm not free. I don't have the free range of possibilities, let's say, in being a parent. And so then that's how that's transmitted down. Do you kind of see how that works? I mean, that's very brief.
Yeah, I do.
And I'm not saying that's a hypothetical case, by the way. I'm just saying as, like, for a quick example. Why is self-destructive?
I have self-destructive, but when it comes to raising my daughter, I'm clear.
Yeah, that's not a necessary transition. If someone does enough work, then they learn to integrate their own trauma, take it up in a different way, and then are free and available to be a good parent. So it's not like cause and effect. It's like this is a tendency of how it rolls. Right, but your question, your second one, was also like, why is it self-destructive? Kind of
why
stuff
did
that
I self-destruct?
Up.
What caused it? You know, because I'm not a perpetrator, so I'm a perpetrator to myself. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We tend to be our own worst enemies, as it were. So,
yeah.
Right. Well, why does that come up? Why is it self-destructive stuff that comes up? All right. Well, in a nutshell, in the first book, I outline that process. And basically, what it is that, okay, these are a series of behaviors and reactions to a very threatening circumstance or a protracted stress is also pretty threatening. No one likes being under protracted stress. That's awful. And that becomes kind of traumatizing. So then there are self-soothing kind of techniques. There are strategies that are employed. One may be self-soothing, which may lead to things like pain management, whether that be the first drink where someone says, oh, I finally feel comfortable in my own skin. Or perhaps that's heroin. Perhaps that's cocaine. Perhaps that's another drug. Another way that that can be taken up is psychically, sort of in someone's mind. There's a threat in reality. In my mind, I'm going to take a step back from reality because that's protecting myself. I'm going to withdraw a little bit. But in that withdraw, I'm also cutting off some of the nutrients that are needed for me to be in reality, to exercise those muscles, as it were, to be engaged back in reality. Now, reality is going to be a little bit more intimidating for me to reconnect with because now I've lost some of those skills. So then I take, that's traumatic, so then I take one more step back from reality, which further takes away some of the contact with reality that I need to build the muscle, as it were, to contend with reality more. So now that, you see, that's a downward spiral. So one can be substance abuse, one can be kind of withdrawal from the world in one's mind or in concrete ways. I withdraw from work, I withdraw from where I was living, I withdraw from this friendship or that, to kind of withdraw as a self-protective measure, but in self-protecting, or in the case of using drugs and or alcohol, those do work in a very temporary way, but I'm kind of withdrawing from reality, which is what I need to be in contact with reality. So then before long, that becomes self-destructive. A third way is that trauma also introduces us to a lot of very, very, very powerful emotions, powerful affects, without giving us the skills to know how to metabolize, so to speak, those affects. So then we're stuck in a space where we have way too much affect of one kind or another, or sometimes confused, combined, warped, etc., and no way to really metabolize it. And that also becomes a self-destructive process. So even in the case of a fourth example, such as a common self-cutting, that's a way of trying to solidify the personality. I feel pain. I know I'm real because I see the blood. Things like that are attempts to consolidate, to feel, to be in one's skin, one's personality, because they're feeling the pain and seeing the blood. But that's also a destructive process because that isn't going to be a long-standing solution to whatever it is one is trying to soothe or consolidate the personality around. So those are four examples I can think of real quick.
You're totally making sense to me. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Well, good. I'm glad. Yeah,
if I don't cut, I don't cut, but I have isolated.
Right. They're all attempts at survival. That's the paradoxical thing about self-destructive behavior. They're attempts at the personality to survive and to contend with really awful situations. They're not self-destructive for self-destruction's sake. They're there to serve a self-protective means, but it's just that in the cost-benefit analysis, it doesn't work out over time. You know, if someone's smoking cigarettes or drinking alcohol or taking drugs, eventually the cost is pretty high.
Thank
what
you.
About
You've
what
given
about
me
exploring
information
some...
that I, you know, new information to help me. Thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome. I'm really glad
Definitely.
I said something that's helpful.
Because I
or
am
useful.
Like learning,
yeah.
trying to learn everything, and you gave me new information.
Oh, you're so welcome.
And then
it's a paradoxical and slippery process. So it's really hard to understand. It took me forever to figure it out too.
Thank you.
You're so welcome.
One thing I wanted to explore, Brent, and Jill alluded to this when she talked about developing cancer, I wondered what your thoughts and beliefs were about how the traumas and distresses that we take on can lead to physical disease.
Oh, yes. I am very, very much on board with that perspective. One of the outcomes of the ACE studies is that they were surprised at the strength with which developmental stress and trauma led to later substance abuse dependence and also what would be labeled as psychiatric issues. Well, guess what? A third thing that they found out that a lot of us don't talk about enough because we're focused on the psychological aspects, because that's generally what we're doing, is they found a whole host of physical, very real, you can, unlike so-called psychiatric diseases, you can see, measure, test for these physical diseases that also correspond very strongly with developmental stress and trauma. So absolutely your intuition is correct that developmental stress and trauma is also highly strongly linked with later physical diseases. And there is a fantastic book that's out by Gaber Mate called When the Body Says No. And one of the things it's real good. One of the things he looks at in there is people, especially who are caretakers, in the sense that I'm going to take care of everyone else's needs. I'm going to make sure everyone else is well attended to. How are you? I need to make sure you're okay. People who are a little bit too much in the caretaking role often develop, things like cancer and other real physical ailments because the body, it's like the body becomes the boundary setter, as it were. The body finally responds and says no. It's like you're not taking care of yourself. You're worried about everyone else. You're
me.
You know, yeah.
Me. Totally.
Yeah.
Go on. Yeah.
Well, no, yeah. I can, especially I think this book is for, a lot of us who are in caretaking roles, wellness recovery roles, you know, this is really good information because, of course, you know, that's a shadow side to caretaking is, you know, where the boundaries are and when we're doing too much for someone else, and then the body is left to be the boundary setter and say, you know, the body just shuts down and says, well, now we've got this disease because, you know, we weren't taking care of ourselves. So, yeah.
And see, I was raised, I'm not allowed to have boundaries, and it's about everybody else.
Right, right.
So it's a struggle for me to like, make myself a priority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Self-care, I mean, is a word that's tossed around too loosely.
It's selfish.
And it's tossed around. Right. And it's tossed around so much that people don't really realize that, you know, if me, you, everyone, if we're not really taking care of ourselves, not in a narcissistic, selfish, self-centered way, but unless we're really taking care of ourselves in a way that works for us, then we really aren't available to be the best people we can be in relationships, whether that be professional or personal. But, yeah, the right way to self-care, and not just say, oh, it's self-care. You know, that is, you're correct. That's a really important piece that a lot of us miss.
You know, I was thinking from the standpoint of becoming healthier emotionally and eliminating stress from our lives, how that can strengthen our immune systems and keep us at bay from things like the common cold or flu.
Well, yeah, stress is, I mean, again, hit the nail on the head. Stress is the enemy, as far as I can tell. I have seen some research that talks about optimal stress levels or good stress because it's motivating, and I find that totally and completely unconvincing. I think that motivation is sufficient enough to be motivated. I don't think people need
I agree. I maintain the attitude.
Stress is
the enemy. I believe in following one's way and one's passion.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't need some unseen influence creating stress to motivate me. And I don't appreciate it. I don't put up with it anymore for the most part. You know, I'm
totally
not perfect yet.
And completely agree. Yeah, and it's a practice. It's not a perfect. And yeah, but stress is the enemy. I think that there, I don't have the statistics in front of me, so please Google it for yourself for anyone listening. But I believe something like 84% of Americans die of a heart-related disease. Like most of us are going to die from some kind of cardiac disease or something like that. And what is that directly linked to? Stress. Everything, stress. You look at cancer rates and how cancer, it's stress is always mentioned. You look at depression, stress. You look at relapse potential, stress. Why do people use drugs? Stress. I mean, across the board, stress is the word that keeps popping up over and over and over again in a variety of different contexts. It's something to be eliminated or reduced as much as humanly possible.
Well, I like the word de-stress. I think, you know, that's my ultimate goal is to de-stress, de-stressify those elements in my life that have caused me stress in the past, to not attach myself to things that take me down at any level, and to only attach myself to positive influences, people, places, and things, and let the rest go. Bless them on their way if they're people, and if they're things or places that are unhealthy for me, I just stay away.
Yeah, those are some wise words. And you know, the other thing I think is kind of to contextualize it a little bit is I think that there is too much attention paid to the individual and not enough to the very toxic culture. Times in which we live. We are exposed to all different kinds of, and again, if you don't believe me, please go do your own research. I think you'll find the same thing, that we are exposed to a number of toxins, stressors, money. Our culture is so incredibly toxic in so many different ways that I don't think it's impossible to completely be stress-free, zero stress. And to realize that, like, this is not going to be a perfect process because I live in a culture that's very toxic. So what are some of the ways? It's like harm reduction. It's like, so what are some of the things, as you aptly point out, that I can take out of my life? Maybe it's a negative people-ectomy or something like that. Who are the negative people, toxic people in my life that maybe need to less contact or perhaps no contact or places or things or activities? Or nutrition, or whatever it is, those areas that we can work on to reduce it and to be kind to ourselves in the process, realizing that it's not going to reach some polished, perfect state.
Well, you know, we could do a whole show around that. Jill, do you have a closing question for the doctor?
Well, disease means not at ease, right?
Right, correct, yes.
No, I just really want to thank you because I beat myself all the time up all the time for self-destructing, and then you gave me my answer. So thank you.
Oh, I'm thrilled that you found that helpful. I mean, you're so very welcome.
Totally.
I always pray before I go on a show that I say something.
Well, there you go.
It'll be used for a helpful. So great. I'm really happy that was helpful.
It was totally helpful. You have no idea.
Well, you're very welcome.
With that said, I want to thank you, Brent, and I would welcome having you back again, and perhaps we can do the show with Christine the next time. So thank you for joining me.
On her behalf, she was called away at the last minute, just couldn't make it, but it'd be great if she came back on and we could, you know, talk about healthy wellness solutions where we're trying to provide multiple approaches to wellness and things like that. But I really, really appreciate you having me on the show. This has just been an outstanding experience and downright pleasant, if you ask me.
And thank you,
welcome.
Because you helped me tremendously. You gave me an answer I was searching for.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Life-changing.
And thank you again for having me on. I really appreciate it.
And thank you for being on.
No problem.
Well, let's do it next year, Brent. Okay,
all right,
the year's
I look
coming
forward
to
it, man. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I think maybe February or March would be great. And I'll send you an email, and we'll set up a date. Okay, so, folks, now we come to a close. We can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There's no real thing of separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.